Welcome to Community Conversations, a monthly program on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and this evening we're talking domestic violence, other voices. I'll have my guests in the studio introduce themselves.
My name is Jeremy Neville Sorrell. I'm co-director of Bending the Sacred Hoop, and we are primarily working with Native communities doing domestic violence and sexual assault, organizing, education, providing training, and technical assistance.
I'm Carol Thompson, and I work with the Domestic Abuse Project, facilitating men's groups, as well as doing training on the men's curriculum.
My name is John Berry. I as well work with Carol and do similar things along with training and also facilitating men's groups at the Domestic Abuse Intervention Project. I also work as a counselor here at the university.
Carol, let's lay a little groundwork. Let's talk about some of the sea changes that have come about as we learn more and we try to do better when it comes to domestic violence. There is a difference between violence, using force, and battering. Can you explain that?
So when we talk about violence, we talk about events, that there's a violent event, somebody fights with somebody else, but it's not an ongoing process. And the battering is an ongoing process of trying to control another person's thoughts, behaviors, feelings, activities, whatever, and the threat to punish them if they don't comply. And then using force, or sometimes we call it resistive violence, and that happens when somebody is being battered, a woman is being battered, she will fight back in some way, and that is resistive violence. It's still violence, but it comes out of the battering. It doesn't, she's not a perpetrator. And so when you think of it, you need to understand the reality of a woman who is being battered and where that's coming from. Doesn't mean it's okay. But it does, you work with it in a different way. You don't work with it like you work with somebody who is battering.
There is the component of psychological abuse or emotional abuse or verbal abuse is considered battering. How does that compare from the victim's perspective to physical abuse?
Victims often say that they'd rather be hit than have this ongoing kind of dehumanizing thing that's happening that really takes away their selves. You know, the name calling, the putting down, the making fun of, you know, the not allowing them to make participate in decisions, they lose themselves. And there's nothing that can identify that. But if you have a bruise, somebody knows, you know, that is going on. And when there's battering going on, the person isn't hitting or kicking or burning them all the time. There might be one incident that happened, but then they know it can happen again. And so then all he has to do is call them a name, stare at them, make fun of them to get them to do what he wants them to do. And he will do whatever he needs to do to get her to comply. And so that's where in battering, you can't predict exactly what he is willing to do. If she doesn't comply, it can happen very fast because his intent is to get her to do what he wants her to do now. And when she doesn't do that, he can call her a name. She doesn't do that. He can slap her. He can throw her down the stairs. He can do whatever he needs to do to get her to comply with what he wants at the time. You know, it's interesting when you ask them if they've been violent, they will say things like, well, I never hit her, or I didn't hit her with a closed fist. And that's kind of what they think is violent. Their definition of violence doesn't include calling her a name, doesn't include making fun of her, doesn't include even forcing sex, even though that's pretty much an ongoing process in relationships where battering is going on. So their definition really prevents them from seeing what else is violent in the relationship.
There seems to be a move toward more focus on the abuser, and instead of trying to keep the woman safe and she has to live in hiding maybe, our primary focus is keeping him away from her and making him accountable and making him change his actions. That is a shift from almost an exclusive focus on the victim. Talk about that shift. Where did it come from, and how are we seeing it played out
in particular here in our community.
The program for men who batter started as a result of realizing that if you don't do something to stop the battering, we'll have shelter upon shelter upon shelter all over the country. And so that was the move. And the move into working with men is really about the safety of women. Our primary goal is to keep women safe by working with men and holding them accountable. One of the tricky parts of holding men accountable is that you always have to have in your mind, are we holding him accountable in a way that's going to make more danger for her? And so that her safety is always primary. And so we might think that holding him accountable might be that he needs to go to jail for 90 days. And she might say, that is not going to work for me because he's the only income and I need his money. He needs to be working. And so there needs to be some thought to how we hold him accountable. And the thought is, how is this going to impact her the way we're holding him accountable? And so there's lots of places that are working, have better systems to hold him accountable, which doesn't necessarily mean that she's in more danger and she has to hide. One of the things women say is that when men are in our program, we have a 26-week program that we work with men. They come in weekly for a group for an hour and a half. They say they feel they are safer when he's in that program because he's under somebody else's eye. He's also on probation. And then they are safer because he knows if he reoffends, he's going to go back to jail. And he doesn't want to do that. Jail is the last place these guys want to be. They hate it. And so even if that's their only motivation, at least they're going to stop. As we look at the whole issue of battering, we need to think about the whole society and how much violence is out there and how much we defer to men because they're men and think that they need to be protected instead of challenged and held accountable.
Well, this comes back to like a point that I think this definition and belief system that surrounds masculinity. And in a sense, it supports violence and this notion of power and control.
You're listening to Community Conversations on KUMD. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and our program this evening is Domestic Violence, Other Voices. Our guests in the studio are John Barry, counselor with UMD's Health Services and co-facilitator of a group for men who batter, Carol Thompson, co-facilitator of men's groups with the Duluth Project, and Jeremy Neville Sorrell, co-director of Mending the Sacred Hoop. John, tell us about the men who come to your groups. Do they all come because they're court-ordered?
I would say that a majority of the men that we see are court-ordered.
Do they come in with a sense of resentment? Are they making fun of the idea of being there? Are they resistant to the idea of being there? What's their mindset?
I think there's a defensiveness to it. I think there's a level of resistance as well. There's a sense, is I think, if with many of the men, when you ask them, you know, what brought you here, it's very hard to identify what it was that actually was the event or series of events. As Carol's pointed out, it's a cycle, series of events that have been part of this violence. And I think it's very difficult for men to recognize. I think, again, not only is it a defensive piece, but also it's a part of which it's just not recognized. It's not understood. And again, I think this plays in the role that men have a hard time seeing the impact of their violence on others, and specifically their partners and their children.
As you begin to work with these men and you begin to kind of unpack their mindset and the circumstances and the thought processes that got them to where they are, what do you find? What are they thinking?
Well, this is a great point. And what we do in group is really this idea of that our actions are a byproduct of our belief system. And where this belief system, again, how this belief system is shaped from our culture, from our environment around us, influences how we behave. And so, with this notion in mind, historically, I think understanding the historical context of masculinity in our culture has been dominated with this notion of masculinity being tied to power and control. And so I think it's not just the men in the group that experience that, but I think myself as well as a man has experienced that as being part of this culture of what it means to be defined by the greater society around us. And so in understanding this, again, these are where the roles and expectations are shaped for how I act and how I'm expecting others to act, including my partner, including my children, and the consequences that follow when those expectations aren't met. And that's where we talk about these behaviors, these actions playing out, and these actions being limiting resources, cutting back finances, maybe preventing her from being able to go out and spend time with friends or being around resources, minimizing past use of violence, denying that it even occurred, blaming her that it's her fault for this, that if she just did things differently, this wouldn't be continuing to happen. And this is a really, again, a belief system that is really believed that this is justified, and that you know she needs to follow these expectations because that's what you do.
What is the missing piece or the connective piece between a man who says, you know, I grew up in the same culture and I have the same sense of a desire for power and control, and yet I understand that there is a boundary there, that I don't hit my partner, I don't belittle my partner, I treat my partner with respect, and the man that goes to, yes, I will hit you if you don't do as I ask?
So if we understand it based off of that our actions come from our belief system, right, is that all of these actions hold the same purpose, right? So all these tactics that are used are holding the same purpose, which is to maintain power and control. So how I go about doing that, you know, again, differs on the situation, differs on the resistance that my partner might have against that.
I think that also that, you know, that John is talking about beliefs and the belief that I'm the man, I'm the boss, I'm right, I know everything, you don't know anything. When a man really has those kind of absolute beliefs, he holds them in an absolute way, violence will result.
How do you go about creating condition for change? How can you break down those attitudes? Because if you're asking a man to give up those belief systems, you're in essence asking him to forfeit a small amount or a large amount of power and control.
That's a great point. And I think part of this is the concept of breaking that, and that because it really is about them making that change. And that really as the years that I've been doing facilitation, I've learned that it's about a process and it's about meeting them where they're at and working with them to really what we call deconstruct that experience, their own belief system. And so it's really not about me making them get to a place or me expecting something from them, but providing an opportunity for dialogue and discussion. My experience has been men are very unhappy when they come into the group. They're miserable. They're not in a place where they say, man, I love just my relationship. I love life. I think all this power and control and these expectations have led them to feel pretty inadequate. And so I think deep down inside, I believe that many of these men want to change. They want to see things differently. They want things to be in a better place. You know, their buy-in, I believe, comes to how do I want to work to change as a man? And that's hard sometimes because if you don't see the impact, if you don't see the effects, which being a male, understanding there's privilege in that and that there's this missing piece that I don't see the effects of my behavior directly. And so I have a hard time understanding it. So we work a lot around empathy. Understanding what it's like being in a situation where you don't get a voice, where your opinion doesn't matter, where how you act and how you behave dictates the evening and how you feel as though it dictates the evening, and that you're under this pressure and under this feeling as though you can't escape it, and that this isn't just happening only at home, but it happens when you go out with this person, when it happens with your children. It happens in this whole encompassing way. And that's, I think, a challenge for men to see that, and I think to understand that.
You know, one of the ways that we work with men is we use something called a log that comes out of Paulo Freire's thinking, and it's a critical thinking process. And so we really are opening up the world to them in a different way, trying to help raise their consciousness about who they are, how they are, how they impact other people. And that whole process that we keep going over and over and over again, they start seeing themselves, and we do all this writing on the board about actions, intents, beliefs, effects, and they see themselves on the board in a different way than they had in their head. And as we do it in a group, every man isn't saying the same thing, and every man identifies with what's on the board. And eventually they look at it and they say, that's who I am. It's who I not don't want to be.
I think one of the critical areas that as you're doing the work with individuals, you have to make it link up with what we're trying to change in society. That's one of the biggest issues, is linking it to those different forms of oppression. You know, we're talking about sexism in society, really, is what creates the violence against women. And it's that same dynamic of anyone in a power group versus those not in a power group. It's hard for them to really see their actions or themselves. When people challenge that authority, they feel like they're wronged. And there's that sense of entitlement and those privileges that come with that. And that's one of the hugest obstacles for men to really understand, is that that when we're challenging their beliefs and looking at society, that issue of power and giving up and losing power is a really big factor, because they think that they're missing out on a whole lot in order to have a good relationship, because these privileges are told to you that, you know, you should be able to do this, that you're a man and you're head of household. Everything around that is shaped by the social norms that we're getting them to look at. And then how it connects with you in your own life is a big piece in helping people understand how individually they fit that mold.
There's different levels of aha moments in the group, but I recall one where a person looked at the board, and he looked at, we were dealing with a tactic of power and control, and he looked at the board and he said, "I know now why Amy will never love me again." And so they come to it in lots of different ways. Another man looked at the effects on women, looked at the board, and he said, "You know, that is Maria on the board there. And that is the person I created by how I treated her. That is not who she was when we began a relationship. I want the other Maria back. And to have the other Maria back, I know I need to change." Those are big, big things. And those two people were not depressed about it. They were at a place in their change process where they accepted this and accepted who they were and how they were and wanted to be different people. In the middle of the process, you see a lot of guys really struggling with, oh gosh, you know, I know I need to change. They don't say this out loud, but you just see them struggle with the change that they're facing, and it doesn't look pretty to them.
You're listening to Community Conversations on KUMD. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and our program this evening is Domestic Violence, Other Voices. Our guests in the studio are John Berry, therapist with UMD Health Services and co-facilitator of a group for men who batter, Carol Thompson, co-facilitator of men's groups with the Duluth Project, and Jeremy Neville Sorrell, co-director of Mending the Sacred Hoop. Jeremy, I was so glad that you were able to take part in this, because I really wanted to have somebody from the Native American community talk about this. I've heard so often that in traditional Native American culture, women were so important and women were so revered. Is that true?
Yes, it is. The traditional concepts in the culture is all about having balance. And so with everything that you do, the way that you live your life, your relationships, all have balance in there. So it's the male-female balance. Everyone brings something and has a gift and has knowledge that they provide to the community.
So how and why did that change? The Justice Department says that Native women are assaulted as much as 50 50% higher, or assaulted at a rate like 50% higher than the next most victimized demographic. Mm-hmm. What happened?
Yeah, they're even experienced more violence than black males. So that number is staggering when you think of a lot of the crime and gang violence in places like Detroit and L.A. It's really astronomical. And most of the people assaulting them are not Native people. And largely because there's most of the population who do not live on reservations. About 60% of the Native population in this country live in urban areas. Much, you know, against what people think of Native people living on reservations and, you know, pueblos all over the place. But no, it's a large urban Native population in this country. But all that started a lot with colonization of the United States. And during that time of colonization, that people were forced to relocate, pushed in other areas, and trying to assimilate Native people into mainstream culture, there is what's called the boarding school era. For about 150 years, Native people were pulled, or Native children were pulled out of their communities, put into these boarding schools run by different religious groups. Some were run by the military. And in that process of taking children away and away from that upbringing, that it impacted the way that they're able to parent and learn those traditions. And in a lot of the places, there was also violence and sexual abuse that happened there. So you put a kid in a place for 10, 12 years and then put them back in the community, and that's what they've been learned and taught to deal with these things in this wave of being violent, that's what you bring back. And you have that disconnect. And you do that for generation after generation after generation, so things become deteriorated. And also, there's up until 1978, it was illegal to practice your culture. You would go to jail just for doing your ceremonies. And so people don't really realize that either, that not only were people taken out of the community, but your culture was banned and made illegal. And then other effects, too, of relocation efforts, getting people to move off of reservations and into urban areas. There's a big push during the 50s. So you got incentives to go get jobs and put in factory things and those type of things. So all of that helped erode and make people a little more disconnected from their identity.
So how does a Native man's effort to exert power and control over a woman connect to, or does it connect at all, with a sense that he may have that he has less power and control in society at large to begin with?
That is a challenge. You know, when we're out there doing the work in the community, helping people organize, the racism is what takes over more so than the violence against women and the sexism. And that is a challenge. And a lot of Native men don't see themselves as having power in that same comparison. But it's easier to make the analogies for Native men because they can understand what it's like living under that with the oppression, with racism. Like, look at institutions. How have institutions affected Native people? And you can break that down and map it out. What are the stereotypes of Native people? And how are Native people are to be believed? And you do the comparison. How do institutions control women? What are stereotypes about women? And you could do those side by side so they can at least get a connection to those larger things. But again, it's still going to have to change that individual as well. You know, you can make the big connections pretty easy, but the inside personal belief system is one that's definitely a challenge still.
What kind of challenges does it present to work with a group of men who are abusers, and yet you're very much aware that they are also suffering? Yeah, that they also have been victimized, not in the same way, and not to make it all right, not to condone violence against women, but to realize that they really do have an awful lot of baggage that they're bringing to the table.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that the historical piece is it's a way of being conditioned in a way, you know, that you're conditioned to react to like or dislike something, you know, along the way. And that's the one thing about the impact of that trauma, is that two or three generations later, you don't know what this thing is that you don't like, but you know it's there. And so that experience gets transferred on to people and imposed upon them. I tend to think of historical trauma as the more acceptable term for talking about institutionalized oppression. Because really, it's all those forms of oppression that lead people to act this way. But we have a sense of looking at individuals and our social problems as individual people problems. And it's much easier to say, look at that person over there. It's their individual trauma, and I can work with that. Because I can't look at the big picture saying this is social oppression. It's the same thing when you're asking about the services for women. How did it shift to put attention on men? Because we could work with the people who are asking for help, but not dealing with the big picture stuff. It's men's violence that's creating these women who need services. I seriously believe that one of the biggest contributors to violence is heterosexism and homophobia. The fear of a man being perceived as being gay, less than, a wimp, you know, the B word, all of that stuff is that pressure is put on men by other men. It's not put on by women. Walking down a dark alley at night, I'm going to see 100 women and babies coming at me, and I'm not going to be afraid at all. But just put another man in that alleyway, and I'm going to be afraid. I'm going to be guarded. And so that's the type of conditioning that we don't really realize it's there.
Identity is like, where's my identity now? So what we want to do in our groups is provide alternatives. And that goes again with as you know, Carol brought up with that logging that we do, is to for them to begin the process of examining it. Because many men will say, I do not believe that hitting women is okay, or that I don't believe harming women is okay, yet they're in the group. We contrast the power and control wheel with the equality wheel. We've spent a lot of time focusing on that because that's something that is a different thinking.
John, when you and I talked yesterday, you made a point that I thought was so important to bring out because it affects everyone who meets a boy. You talked about how boys are being conditioned or preconditioned from the time they first start hanging out with other boys. And if they don't conform, you're called names, you're likened to a woman, you're a sissy, you're a girl, whatever, and you hit the homophobic slam, even if you can be confident or fairly confident as a parent that you're not raising a son who's a batterer. Is our society creating abusers by conditioning boys this way, by allowing them to interact with one another this way without trying to interfere, without trying to intervene?
I think part of this change is about as men, including myself, is this process of how do we work to challenge these core beliefs that are unhealthy and supportive of violence and creating an unsafe environment for women and children. The idea is like, what are we teaching boys then? That you have to be tough, they have to be strong. And so even through those early interactions, we're teaching children how to be and how to behave. And again, I bet all of, you know, each one of us as men have stories surrounding what Jeremy pointed out about being called gay or other just names that say you are not to be outside this box. You are to stay in this box. And there are serious consequences by other men if you get out of this box. And I think as men, I would hope and I believe that we really want to start changing this. I have hope that we would.
I think the other piece about that is, you know, the way we think about boys in the culture and the bigger culture, no matter how parents are, we say boys will be boys. You know, boys are violent at school, so we treat them one way. Girls are violent at school and everybody's in an uproar about it because girls are not supposed to be violent. Boys can, but girls are not. They're different consequences. And I think one of the struggles that the men in going through our groups have, and they talk about this, is one of the guys said, being nonviolent means I'm going to die because I'm not going to be able to defend myself. And they talk about the fact that, you know, there's all this violence out there. And so the work that we do with men needs to be much bigger. It needs to look at how do we decrease violence in our communities? What kind of community do you want to live in? And what are we going to do to make that change? Because we all support the violence. If we didn't support the violence, any kind of violence, it wouldn't exist. And so we're all participating in this in some way. We're all giving a stamp of approval. We may not think we are, but we are.
Community Conversations is a monthly program here on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and our program this evening is called Domestic Violence, Other Voices. You can listen to this program again online. Search Community Conversations at KUMD.org under Audio Archives. Our thanks to our guests, John Berry, a therapist with UMD's Health Services and co-facilitator of a group for men who batter, Carol Thompson, co-facilitator of men's groups with the Duluth Project, and Jeremy Neville Sorrell, co-director of Mending the Sacred Hoop. Community Conversations is produced by Lisa Johnson with help from Chris Harwood and funded by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.